Welcome to Stout Audio, produced at Spruce Knob Studios in Middletown Springs, Vermont. Stout brings you stories and ideas about the things you've seen a thousand times but never really looked at. Welcome to the show. Here's your host, Herb Childress. Welcome back to Stout Audio and this week's story. But before we jump in, we need to talk. A little over a year ago, I was at a writer's conference, and one of the facilitators for the week was the poet Patricia Smith, terrific writer and terrific person. And one of the sessions that she led was on the idea of cultural appropriation, on being respectful when you write about people whose lives are unlike your own. It's a huge topic in the writing community, and there's some pretty strong camps drawn up, a fair bit of acrimony. And Patricia said something that stuck with me ever since. She said, "We have the right to write about anything or anyone that we're interested in, but we have the responsibility to stick around and be part of the conversation that ensues." And I thought the world of that idea. We do bear responsibility for whatever we put out into the world, whether it's a concerto, or Frankenstein's monster, or just, you know, a tweet. And this story has raised that question for me in a close way. I shared it last winter with the members of my small writing group. One of the members of that group is gay, and he wrote a really heartfelt personal note to me, in which he told me that he felt I was not doing justice in this story to the traumas faced by the gay community, not doing justice to the dangers that being gay in the late 1970s would have posed. I was, and am, grateful for that message, grateful that he took the time to reach out to me and to help me think carefully once again about the responsibilities of the writer. But although I've revised it a bit since then, I still stand behind it. I'm not gay, but I do know what it's like to be an alien among the other kids in school. I do know what it's like to wish for a larger world than a small factory town can offer. I don't know whether Dan, the protagonist of this story, is or isn't gay. I don't think that Dan knows. It's set in the Midwest in 1979, after all. The notion of what it meant to be gay wasn't very widely discussed, much less the notion that there are a lot of different ways to be gay, or that gay and straight aren't the only two options in the world. I think Dan's just lonely and confused and wanting something more. And that's an experience that I know. Jim Barlow of the Houston Chronicle once wrote of the crime writer Dick Francis that, quote, "He writes believable fairy tales for adults, ones in which the actors are better than we are, but believable enough to make us wonder if, indeed, we could not one day manage to emulate them." And that's been my aspiration as well, to write as though we might be able to be better than we are, to be smarter and kinder and more generous than we usually find ourselves. As Jane Austen wrote in Mansfield Park, "Let other pens dwell on guilt and misery." So with all that in mind, here's this week's story. And I hope that I'll hear from you about it, whether it pleases you or angers you, or you don't even know how to feel about it. It's set in 1979 in Menominee, Michigan and Green Bay, Wisconsin, and it's called Angels Among Us. Dan sat by himself mid-bus, watching and not watching the snowy streets. Boisterous conversations all around him, the bus segregated by age, juniors and seniors in the cool, distant rear, ninth and tenth graders over the wheel humps, junior high kids mid-bus, and the squirts all up front around the driver. The route was half done, so the seating was getting more sparse, and Dan had moved forward to be out of the chatter about hockey practice and the catfights of cheerleaders. He opened his notebook, sang the handwritten lyrics silently, along with the Elvis Costello song in his head. "Oh, I used to be disgusted, and now I try to be amused. But since their wings have got rusted, you know the angels want to wear my red shoes." Dan wanted red shoes. He wanted to dance with the angels, to feel their rusted wings. He wanted to live in London, see the Sex Pistols at the 100 Club, listen to The Clash in the basement of Hope and Anchor, buy his records at Rough Trade. Or at least to live in Greenwich Village, see Blondie at the Lismar Lounge and television at CBGB. Wanted to live in a place where it was always nighttime. But instead, he was in spiritual exile on the wrong continent with the wrong kids on a Thursday afternoon in Menominee fucking Michigan. His subscription to Rolling Stone felt like bi-weekly letters to a prisoner. "We're still here," it said. "We're waiting for you." He was jolted sideways as Johnny and Pete, the hockey jocks, came down the aisle from behind, lugging their giant Bauer equipment bags. Just as Dan had learned to make himself small, Johnny and Pete made their way in the world by taking up even more space than their 6-foot weight room bodies already demanded. Pete looked over his shoulder, that cruel, smug grin. "Sorry, Diane." Giant, stupid people. He was surrounded by giant, stupid people. He felt like a fallen angel sent to live among the primitives. He put his head down again, back into his private, pure, untouchable world. He climbed down off the bus, slipping once on the ice at the foot of the driveway, but holding himself upright. He had a moment of annoyance when he saw Kate's car in the driveway. He wanted to put on the Ramones loud and escape his geographical prison for a couple of hours. But still, he hadn't seen her in a few weeks. She was nearly done with college in Milwaukee. He'd have all weekend to listen to his records. It'd be nice to talk to his sister for a while, get some borrowed stories of city life. "Hey, Kate, what brings you back to the wilderness?" He smelled the beginnings of meatloaf from the kitchen as he came through the door, hung his coat. "Hey, Danny." The only person in the world with permission to call him Danny. "Mom and I are going to spend the weekend shopping for my wedding dress." "Where are you going to get a wedding dress in Menominee? Or are you going to get married in goalie pads?" She chopped onions. "No, smartass. We're going up to Iron Mountain. There's a dress shop up there called Irene's." "Sounds like some Youper folk song." He composed a song on the spot. "Iron Mountain Irene, she's homely and she's mean. She's 6'4", 250 or more," he paused for a rhyme, "and smells like gasoline." He had a sudden cheerful thought as he picked up a dish towel to dry the spoons and bowls she'd washed. "At least I get the house to myself all day Saturday." "Yeah, so you can have all your girlfriends over," she grinned. "Mr. Suave making the moves." She composed a song of her own. "Menominee Dan, he's the man with the plan. If he can't find a girl, he'll make out with his hand." He snapped her in the butt with a dish towel as she laughed at her own song. "Ow! Sorry to dispel your fantasy weekend, buddy. I think Dad's planning on taking you with him to his tournament." "What? Oh, for Christ's sake. I have to spend a weekend in a fucking bowling alley in Green Bay?" He held out his arms, palms up, wrists bent back. "You've got the knife. Take me now. Put me out of my misery." "Give it another 10 or 20 years. Can't have you die a virgin." "Oh, you should know. You passed that milepost a while back. Is Mom going to let you wear a white dress, or does she have to embroider a scarlet A on it?" She threw a wet dish rag at him. "At least I didn't have to learn about it from Mrs. Berg in World Literature. Does she still get all quivery when she talks about Daisy Buchanan?" He thought back. Gatsby was only a couple of months ago. "Yeah, she was a little flustered, now that you mention it. Shit, I can't believe I have to go to a fucking bowling tournament." "So why can't I stay home? It's not like I'm 12 years old with a Zippo lighter." His father sat down his can of Schlitz and said, "No, you're 17 years old, and there's a house full of liquor and 200 records by depressed people. Why don't you ever listen to anything cheerful?" Dan had gotten 3 new records from Columbia Record Club that afternoon and had played a new Iggy Pop record for his dad after work. Dad was more an Elvis and Johnny Cash sort of guy. "Besides, you always complain about not being able to see city life. Green Bay will be a good change." "Green Bay's not exactly Berlin, Dad." "How would you know?" Kate said. "Why don't you go to Berlin and then tell us about it? Maybe it's just like Green Bay after all. It's all Germans. It'd be beer and bowling and bratwurst, just like Wednesday night at the Elks." "Your Uncle Phil lives in Berlin," Mom said, emphasizing the first syllable to name the Wisconsin town outside Madison. "You should spend some time there. You'd realize the big city life you've got right here." "I still think the stork got lost," Dan said. It was on its way to Paris or Los Angeles or something, and it got blown off course up here to Michigansen. Well, we're glad he dropped you off with us, Mom said. Most of us are glad anyway, Kate said. Nice meatloaf, Kate, Dad said, raising his laden fork in a toast. You're going to make Tom a happy man. I'm betting that's already true, Dan said, and Kate blushed while she tried not to laugh. Now, Daniel, be nice to your sister, Mom said. Everybody deserves their own private life. Yeah, except me, Dan said. I'm going to be stuck eating bowling alley grilled cheese with 100 guys who wear their names on the back of their shirts. Well, nobody'd see it if we just had it written in felt pen on our underwear, would they, Dad said. Be a lot harder to know how to engrave the trophy. Dan was eating his bag lunch in Mr. Renshaw's classroom. Leftover meatloaf sandwich. It was good. A little bag of carrot sticks and a second little bag of Fritos. Two Oreos. Mr. Renshaw was his math teacher this year, a new teacher to replace Mr. Salas, who'd retired. Dan loved Mr. Renshaw and his class, and used his room as a downtime refuge. No jocks ever came voluntarily to a math classroom, and Mr. Renshaw knew some pretty cool music, so there was usually something good on his cassette player while they ate. Today it was Devo, Small Town Misfits, who'd gotten out of Akron. So it turns out that I have to go with my dad down to Green Bay for a bowling tournament this weekend, Dan groused. That could be good, or bad, depending, Mr. Renshaw said. Do you like your dad? Dan loved how direct he was. No bullshit, no earnest do-gooder grown-up crap, just a conversation. Yeah, he's okay. You know how you feel about trigonometric identities? Well, that's how he feels about bowling. It's like this spiritual thing, you know? He must be pretty good. Yeah, but it's weird. Some guys love to do things because they're good at them, and other guys are good at things because they love to do them. He's that kind. Yeah, that's the better kind, I'd say. So what do you do all weekend while he's bowling? I read, do homework, play a little Pac-Man, but that gets tired pretty quick. Maybe I'll just walk around town, he decided to tease Mr. Renshaw a little bit. Find a tavern and sit with my elbows on the bar while the old codgers play Perry Como on the jukebox. There's more than one jukebox in Green Bay. Yeah, but none with Devo or the Damned in it, I imagine. A funny look passed across Mr. Renshaw's face, the same look he had when he was calculating the cosine of 2 theta equals 1 plus the tangent squared of theta in his head. Then he opened his desk drawer, paused, pulled out a book of matches, put them on the desk. I know a place in Green Bay that might suit you better, he said, passing the matches across to Dan. The Gibson men on a road trip, Dad said as they drove away early Saturday morning. The back seat was occupied by 2 double bowling bags, keeping the 4 balls temperature controlled as the suitcases chilled in the trunk instead. Dan's book bag was back there too, radioactive with the secret matchbook tucked in a zip pocket. You gonna kill him, Dad? Well, I've been bowling pretty well for a couple months, and I always liked the way they got him set up at Riviera. I should do okay. But the thing about bowling is you can't play defense. So if some guy comes up from Chicago or Minneapolis and shoots the lights out, there's nothing to be done. Even though Dan didn't care much about bowling, he loved that his dad had something he was so completely into. A plow truck mechanic from a small town could be just some dumbass hockey dad. But his father had been a member of the Professional Bowlers Association since before Dan was born, kept learning new things, practiced diligently. He could tease his dad about it, but he was fiercely proud of him for caring so much. These regional PBA tournaments were his dad's form of going to Mass, a way to experience transubstantiation. They drove down US 41, mostly silent, but as they passed the exit to Peshtigo, Dad took a swig of coffee from his thermos, cleared his throat. So, he said, your mother and I... And then he stopped, never varying his gaze from the highway. Dan filled in the dangling sentence over and over in half a second, discarded all the possibilities. Well, we're wondering why you haven't had any girlfriends. Dan was mortified. Jesus, Dad, if this is going to be a birds and bees talk, you can let me out of the car at this gas station. I know all that stuff about how babies get made and how girls get periods and all that. His dad smiled. Can't grow up with an older sister and not know some of that. He waited a second. We're wondering if maybe we should have a bees and bees talk instead. We don't need to do an interrogation, and the fact is that we love you no matter what, we always will, and we want you to be happy, whoever you're happy with. A mile went by. Dan said, but you want to know. It's kind of a big thing, and mostly we want you to be safe. The world isn't always friendly to people who are different. Dan thought about all the jocks who had taken joy in shoving him around since third or fourth grade, about kids making fun of his music and his hair and his love of math. Yeah, I sort of picked up on that, he sighed. Tell you what, Dad, once I figure it out, you'll be the first to know. Probably the second anyway, Dad laughed. Dan always enjoyed watching the churn of a tournament check-in. Old friends greeting one another and laughing, the ad hoc science of registering two or four balls apiece from 100 bowlers, each ball checked for illegal weighting on a balance scale and checked for hardness with a durometer. Dad had told him stories of a guy who soaked a ball in a bucket of paint thinner after check-in to soften it before a match so it would hook more, and then rushed to the bathroom after a big score to flush it over and over in the cold water of a toilet to harden it back up before it was checked in again. He sat on a lounge chair, half watching, half doing trig problems, and a sizzling little part of his brain occupied by that matchbook. It was only 9 a.m. The bar didn't open until 4. Just like school, he thought. 7 hours before you get your freedom. By 10 o'clock, the first round was underway, each bowler throwing 8 games to winnow the field of 107 down to the top 32. At pro tournaments, the bowlers shifted one pair of lanes rightward after each game to make things as fair and as difficult as they could, and Dan followed along up the concourse, one bar table to the right every 20 minutes or so to be behind his dad. He had had one tough game, a 187, but mostly was throwing 220s and 230s, bowling well. In the sixth game, Dan went to the snack bar and ordered a grilled cheese and fries, watching while he waited as some guy, Jim Donegan, according to his shirt, just missed a perfect game. Dan applauded with the rest of the crowd after he left the 8-pin on his 11th ball on what looked like a great hit for a 289. When the 8th game ended, his dad signed his scorecard and shook hands with the other guys on his pair before coming up, a bowling ball in each hand, setting them on the carpet next to Dan's table. Dan said, "Nice work, Dad. Where are you?" Plus 218, his dad said, using the tournament shorthand. For professionals, a game of 200 was considered par, so a game of 220 would be a plus 20. Dan worked it out quickly. Plus 218 after 8 games was an average of 227.25. Ought to be enough to get me into the afternoon anyway. Let me get something for lunch. I'll join you. He went off to get himself a burger. Dan wandered over to the tournament desk where the organizers were collecting score sheets. A crowd was gathering around to see first-round standings, and his dad found him there. The tournament director, a fat old guy with reading glasses perched down the end of his nose, finally looked up and said, "Cutoff for second round is plus 61. A few groans from bowlers who had fallen just shy, and the group started to filter away. Dan and his dad went back to their table. "If 61 made the cut, you must be toward the top," Dan said. "Probably top 10 anyway," Dad said with his mouth full. "It's good out there, but they'll put up a different shot for the afternoon, so it's one round at a time." Dan looked out as a team of 6 boys, about his age, spread out across the lanes, walking behind their long-handled sweepers to remove the oil from each lane before the afternoon reapplication of oil in a new pattern that would change the way the balls hooked. Dad said, "You going to hang out here for the afternoon, or you want to go see some big city life?" Dan shuddered for a second, but gathered himself. "I'll probably go to the motel and hang out there," he said. "Look in the phone book, see if there's a record shop or something." Dad nodded. "We're in the Travelodge, right across University Avenue from here. I'll probably have dinner here, a couple of beers with some of the guys." He pulled out his wallet, gave Dan 220s. "Go have dinner somewhere nice. Don't just sit in the room and watch TV all day. I'll be back before midnight." He smiled. "That'll be your curfew, too, okay? Don't make me call the Green Bay police to go looking for you. Wait here for a second." He walked over to the control desk, returned with a torn-off piece of score sheet. Here's the bowling alley phone number in case you need anything. Dan packed up his homework, put his book bag over his shoulder. Bowl good this afternoon, okay? Do my best. Have fun. Call me if you need me. They hugged briefly and Dan walked off. As he passed the tournament desk, he saw the chalkboard with the first round results. His dad was in seventh place in a cluster of guys all around plus 200. Donegan, the guy he'd watched throw the big game, was second at plus 304. Another player he didn't recognize at plus 313. He walked over to the motel, a nice pre-spring day in the 40s, checked in with his dad's reservation, got himself camped out on one of the room's matching queen beds. The clock on the bedside table read 2:43. He unzipped his book bag pocket, took out the matchbook, opened it to lie flat. Manhole, 204 South Washington, Green Bay, Wisconsin, 414-435-1495. A terrific punk industrial name. The O of the name, a hand-drawn manhole cover. It looked like a record ad in Rolling Stone. He looked at the map in the phone book, saw that the bar was about 3 or 4 miles from the motel. He put the matchbook into his pants pocket, put on his jacket, went down to the lobby desk. "Can I get a cab?" "You betcha," said the desk clerk, who reminded him of Mrs. Berg. "Where would you like to go?" He played it vague. Downtown, Washington Avenue by the Fox River. And that's how he found himself in a taxi, for the first time in his life. City people took taxis, he thought. Lou Reed probably takes a taxi, and Debbie Harry. Just the fact of being in a cab was disorienting, exhilarating. "What address?" He didn't want to give himself up too easily. 204 North Washington? He hoped that there was a 204 on North Washington, and that North and South Washington weren't divided by some impassable barrier. But no, North and South Washington were just on opposite sides of Walnut Street, and 204 was one of a row of three-story brick commercial buildings. He gave the driver $4 against a $2.85 fare, because spending money casually was what city people did. He walked the 4 blocks to 204 South. Looked at the sign, suspended on a rusty iron bar over a set of stairs down to a dark basement entry. Simple, blocky black letters on white plastic. The raw, industrial character of it scared him. He thought he knew punk from music and record covers and photos, but this was punk staring him in the face, demanding of him that he have the guts to descend into the unknown. He remembered that Mr. Renshaw had sent him, and borrowed strength from that. He went down the stairs, each step seeming to suck the afternoon daylight further away. The damp concrete walls seemed closer, the stairwell narrower. At the bottom, he pulled against the heavy wooden door, walked into a dark room with a long illuminated bar off to his left. The door closed behind him. Wisconsin, another planet altogether. "Hello, stranger," a voice called from behind the bar. "Come on, we don't bite." Dan walked over to the bar, a skinny young man in his mid-20s behind it, wearing a tank top. He looked Dan up and down. "You're new here?" I got the name of the place from a friend. He said I should ask for Ray." The man behind the bar extended his hand. "That's me, Ray Asun. Who are you, and who's your friend?" "I'm Dan. My friend is Mr. Renshaw in Menominee." "Oh, you're Dan. Mr. Renshaw called last night and said we might see you." He laughed. "Mr. Renshaw. I'll have to remember that. Jimmy will like that." "Yes, sir, Mr. Renshaw. Anything you say, Mr. Renshaw." He reached behind the bar, started a turntable. A bright snare followed by an even brighter guitar, flooding the room from what seemed to be hundreds of speakers. It felt like he was swimming in the music, lyrics underwater in reverb. "Joy Division," Ray said. "Just came in last week from England. What can I get you to drink?" Dan wasn't much of a drinker, mostly sips from his dad's beers. Schlitz?" Ray said. Against the law to drink beer when you listen to Joy Division. Let me help. Do you like sweet or tart?" "Tart." "Good. Fizzy or not fizzy?" Not. Good. Wait here." Ray turned his back, as did Dan, surveying the room. The wall behind the dance floor was flat black, with a giant mural of muscular men wearing only leather jackets over their super-tight jeans. The sidewall, also black, with script reading dance in red neon, providing almost the only illumination to that end of the room. "Here you go." Dan turned back to the bar, a stemmed cocktail glass before him filled with a buttery, creamy yellow drink. He took a sip, sour and sweet and rich like a lemon meringue pie in a glass, and then a burn at the back of the throat. "Good? Wow, yeah, really good. What is it?" "Snowball. First one's on me." He looked squarely at Dan. "So when I talked on the phone with Jimmy, he told me a few things about you. He said you're better at math than he was when he was in high school. He said you love music." He smiled. "He said I shouldn't bother looking at your driver's license if I didn't want to learn something I didn't want to know. So you're 18 for the next few hours. Congratulations. And he said you're new to all this, and that I should be the mother hen and protect you from the weasels." He bent down, scooped ice into a glass, poured water, sat it on the bar next to Dan's glass. "Protect you from yourself, too. I know what it's like to go into the oasis after years in the desert. You just want to drink up everything you see. Stick with me. I'll help you pace yourself." The door opened, a blast of outdoor light like a flashbulb. "Showtime," Ray said, and then called to his new guests. "TJ and the Bear, happy Saturday. Come on over and say hello to a new friend." Over the next few hours, Dan met dozens of men. Men who lived in Green Bay, and men who lived in farm villages of a few hundred people. Men who worked in banks, and men who worked in factories. Men from his age all the way up to their 60s. Men of all shapes and sizes. With Ray's encouragement, they told him their own stories, about their secrets, about parents who never accepted, about the ways that they had to travel two counties away from home in order to be who they were, about how they knew and when they knew and who had helped them discover themselves. It was an initiation into the secrets of the lodge, the welcoming of the elders. He danced over and over, one or another of his new guides pulling him into the crowd, the sweat, the hands, the hips, the pulsing of the music, both familiar and new. He spotted a skinny, tall man with red shoes, lost him in the crowd again. Stolen kisses between songs, some timid and gentle, some more forceful and demanding. Finally, he took his stool at the bar one last time. He'd only had 3 drinks in 7 hours, but he felt like he was hallucinating. Like he was in a world where the rules didn't hold, where everything was bent and curved and swooping like a cartoon. Ray leaned his elbows on the bar and said, "We should get you out of here. You need to get back to your dad, and closing time in here is like the last hour of a yard sale. Everybody's picking out things to take home cheap. Your tab's all paid for, by the way. It could have been paid for 20 times over. Everybody thinks you're the cutest puppy they ever seen, and they all want to adopt you. I have something for you." He took 3 sheets of paper, ragged where they'd been torn from their spiral notebook. "I put my playlist on there, so you can listen to some new music when you can't stand another minute of Fleetwood Mac." He came out from behind the bar, hugged Dan for a long time, kissed him on the cheek. "You're welcome here anytime, once you turn 18 for real. And tell Mr. Renshaw that we don't see him enough either." He stepped back, took Dan's hands. "You're going to be okay, Danny. There's a whole world built just for you." Dan got his jacket on, folded the papers into an inner pocket, plucked a matchbook from the mug on the bar, and went up the stairs to the dark, empty streets to the waiting cab that Ray had called. 15 minutes later, he was back at the Travelodge. The clock behind the desk read 11:23. He went to the room, found his dad in the far bed, pillows propped behind him as he sat against the headboard watching TV. "Hey, Dan, have a good time in the big city?" It was like asking Dorothy if she had had fun in Oz. He sighed. Yeah, I did. "You want to tell me about it?" "Maybe sometime." His dad leaned up on one elbow. "Are you okay?" What could he say? How could he explain? "Yeah, I'm good. I am." He went to the bathroom, brushed his teeth, washed his face. He looked in the mirror, felt taller, older, felt that he had shed his childhood all at once, like emerging from a cocoon. He went back into the bedroom, his dad looking protectively at him as he stripped down to his boxers and got into his bed. "Are you bowling tomorrow?" Dan asked. "Yeah, good afternoon. I'm in third right now." "Well, that's great. Did you have a good time with your friends at dinner?" "Yeah, I did. But, you know, I'm the dad, and I get to ask the questions." "You sure you're okay? Anything you want to tell me?" There were a million things he wanted to say, all at once. Every song playing together, every face of every man blended into one portrait that tasted like lemon meringue. "Does it make any sense to say that I'm too happy to talk? Maybe I can tell you more tomorrow." "Okay. Try to sleep." He closed his eyes, but then thought of one thing he had to say. "Dad?" "Yeah?" Worry in his voice. "Thanks for bringing me. I'm glad we're here." The next day, Dan watched as his father cut cleanly through the final field of eight. Did it make sense that watching his father bowl was like listening to Joy Division, like doing a geometric proof, like dancing? It was a wonder, a miracle, the trophy and the handshakes and the $1,000 check, all just meager mementos of the pure, sweet knowledge of grace. Finally, they were in the car, bowling bags in the trunk this time, at ease after having fulfilled their mission. "I haven't watched you bowl for a long time. It was beautiful." "Yeah." His dad was subdued, quiet. "You know what you said last night? Sometimes you're too happy to talk." He took several long, quiet breaths. "I bowled 25 games this weekend, so that's probably 200 strikes. But there were three, one yesterday and two today. I knew where the ball was still on my fingers that I'd hit it, where I didn't even need to watch. Those are the ones that you wait for, the ones that matter." And Dan, crying with the joy of the weekend, told his father everything. That was Angels Among Us, part of the series A Field Guide to Men of the 1970s. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll reach out to let me know what you thought. I'm glad you're here, and I'll look forward to you being back with us again next week on Stout Audio.